Hello, this is Steve Ferrella reading Time Magazine for August 19th, 2019. Cover story says, enough, year of gun violence in America so far, and it has virtually every city in America written on the cover. The terror within. For decades, U.S. officials ignored the growing threat of domestic extremism. That may finally be changing, by Vera Berengruen and W.J. Hennigan. What does a terrorist look like? For more than a generation, the image lurking in Americans' nightmares has resembled the perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks, an Islamic jihadist, not a 21-year-old white supremacist from a prosperous Dallas suburb. But long before that, young man drove to El Paso, Texas on August 3rd and allegedly murdered at least 22 people at a Walmart crammed with back-to-school shoppers. It was clear that white nationalists have become the face of terrorism in America. Since 9/11, white supremacists and other far-right extremists have been responsible for almost three times as many attacks on U.S. soil as Islamic terrorists, the government reported. From 2009 to 2018, the far-right has been responsible for 73% of domestic extremist-related fatalities, according to a 2019 study by the Anti-Defamation League, or ADL. And the toll is growing. More people, 49, were murdered by far-right extremists in the U.S. last year than in any other year since the Oklahoma City bombings in 1995. FBI Director Christopher Wray told Congress in July that a majority of the Bureau's domestic terrorism investigations since October were linked to white supremacy. Yet the nation's leaders have failed to meet this menace. In more than a dozen interviews with Time, current and former federal law enforcement and national security officials described a sense of bewilderment and frustration as they watched warnings go ignored and the white supremacist terror threat grow. Over the past decade, multiple attempts to refocus federal resources on the issue have been thwarted. Entire offices meant to coordinate an intra-agency response to right-wing extremism were funded, staffed, and then defunded in the face of legal, constitutional, and political concerns. Today, FBI officials say just 20% of the Bureau's counterterrorism field agents are focused on domestic probes. This year alone, those agents' caseload has included an investigation into an Ohio militia allegedly stockpiling explosives to build pipe bombs, a self-professed white supremacist Coast Guard officer who amassed an arsenal in an apartment in the greater Washington, D.C. area, an attack in April at a synagogue outside San Diego that killed one, and the July 28th assault at a garlic festival in Gilroy, California that killed three. Cesar Sayoc, a 57-year-old man from Florida, was sentenced to 20 years in prison on October 5th after pleading guilty to mailing 16 pipe bombs to Democrats and critics of President Donald Trump. The FBI has warned about the rising domestic threat for years, but has not had a receptive audience in the White House. As a result, agency leadership hasn't historically prioritized white supremacist violence, even among homegrown threats, for years listing eco-terrorism as the top risk. Former Special Agent Michael German told the House Committee on Oversight and Reform in May. Law enforcement officials say the cancer of white nationalism has metastasized across social media and the dark corners of the internet, creating a copycat effect in which aspiring killers draw inspiration and seek to outdo one another. The suspect in El Paso was at least the third this year to post a manifesto on the online message forum 8chan before logging off to commit mass murder. More people were killed that day in El Paso than all 14 service members killed this year on the battlefields in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. Even if there was a crackdown right now, it's going to take years for the momentum of these groups to fade, says Daryl Johnson, a former senior analyst at the Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, whose 2009 report on right-wing extremism was lambasted by conservatives even before its release. I'm afraid we've reached a tipping point where we're in for this kind of violence for a long time. Right-wing terrorism is a global problem, resulting in devastating attacks from New Zealand to Norway. but it is particularly dangerous in the U.S., which has more guns per capita than anywhere else in the world. An epidemic of mass shootings, a bedrock tradition of free speech that protects the expression of hateful ideologies and laws that make it challenging to confront a disaggregated movement that exists largely in the shadows of cyberspace. Law enforcement lacks many of the weapons it uses against foreign enemies like Al-Qaeda. To defend America from the dangers posed by Islamic terror groups, the federal government built a globe-spanning surveillance and intelligence network capable of stopping attacks before they occurred. Federal agents were granted sweeping authorities by Congress to shadow foreign terrorist suspects. No comparable system exists in domestic terror cases. Domestic terrorism is not even a federal crime, forcing prosecutors to charge suspects under hate crime laws. White supremacy is a greater threat than international terrorism right now, says David Hickton, a former U.S. attorney who directs the University of Pittsburgh Institute for Cyber Law, Policy, and Security. We are being eaten from within, yet Hickton says federal prosecutors are limited in how they try domestic cases. I'd have to pursue a white supremacist with hate crimes, unless he interfaced with Al-Qaeda. Does that make any sense? Then there is a problem of a commander-in-chief whose rhetoric appears to mirror, validate, and potentially inspire that of far-right extremists. The screed posted by the suspected terrorist in El Paso said he was motivated by a perceived Hispanic invasion of Texas. President Trump's campaign has run some 2,200 Facebook ads warning of an invasion at the border, according to a CNN analyst. It's a term he regularly uses in tweets and interviews. People hate the word invasion, but that's what it is, he said in the Oval Office in March. It's an invasion of drugs and criminals and people. The El Paso shooter said his actions were unconnected to Trump. A senior administration official told Time that the criticism linking the president's rhetoric to violence was unfortunate, unreasonable, and obviously politically motivated. In the wake of the El Paso attack, which was followed by a second mass shooting in Dayton, Ohio, roughly 13 hours later, Trump promised to give federal authorities whatever they need to combat domestic terrorism. He said law enforcement must do a better job of identifying and acting on early warning signs, and said he was directing the Justice Department to work in partnership with local, state, and federal agencies, as well as social media companies, to develop tools that can detect mass shooters before they strike. But White House officials did not specify which new authorities are needed, nor does the administration's record offer much hope. In the early days of his presidency, the Trump administration gutted the DHS office that focused on violent extremism in the U.S. and pulled funding for grants that were meant to go to organizations countering neo-Nazis, white supremacists, anti-government militants, and other like-minded groups. The El Paso suspect was born in 1998, 3 years after the worst homegrown terrorist attack in American history, the bombing of Oklahoma City's Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building was carried out by Timothy McVeigh, a Gulf War veteran who wanted to exact revenge against the federal government for the deadly sieges in Waco, Texas, and Ruby Ridge, Idaho. The sprawling investigation that followed McVeigh's attack, which killed 168 people, foreshadowed some of the challenges facing law enforcement today. The bombing helped call attention to the threat of domestic terrorism, but that focus dissipated in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, which drove the full force of the U.S. national security system into fighting Islamic terrorism. From 2005 to 2009, according to a Justice Department audit, the number of FBI agents assigned to domestic terrorism probes averaged less than 330 out of a total of almost 2,000 FBI agents assigned to counterterrorism cases. By the end of George W. Bush's presidency, however, it had become apparent to U.S. officials monitoring such threats that something serious was brewing at home. The prospect of the first black president sparked a sharp rise in far-right groups, from so-called Patriot Movement adherents to anti-government militias, according to analysts at DHS. The Secret Service took the unprecedented step of assigning Barack Obama a protective detail in May 2007, mere months into his campaign, and long before candidates typically receive protection. Johnson, who led a six-person group at DHS's Office of Intelligence and Analysis, began working on a report about the rise of right-wing terrorism. It warned that white nationalists, anti-government extremists, and members of other far-right groups were seizing on the economic crisis and Obama's ascension to recruit new members. Johnson was preparing to release his report when a similar study by the Missouri Information Analysis Center, meant for law enforcement officers, was leaked to the public in February 2009. The paper, titled "The Modern Militia Movement," linked members of these militias to fundamental Christian anti-abortion or anti-immigration movements. The report was pilloried by GOP groups and politicians for singling out conservatives as possible criminals. Missouri officials warned Johnson about the blowback he could expect for publishing a similar analysis. But Johnson, who describes himself as a conservative Republican, says he thought the DHS lawyers and editors who worked on the report would provide a layer of protection from GOP criticism. "I didn't think the whole Republican Party would basically throw a hissy fit," he recalls. But when the DHS report was leaked to conservative bloggers in April 2009, it provoked an outcry from Republicans and conservative media, who painted it as a political hit job by the Obama administration. DHS Secretary Janet Napolitano, who originally issued a broad defense of the report, apologized to the American Legion for one of its most controversial components, a section that raised concerns about military veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, and subsequently being susceptible to targets for recruitment by right-wing groups. Johnson's team was slowly disbanded. The number of analysts devoted to non-Islamic domestic terrorism dwindled from 6 to 0 in 2010, he said. The Missouri and DHS reports were early examples of how the fight against right-wing terrorism would be hamstrung by politics. For years, there's been a visceral response from politicians that if these groups are being labeled as right-wing, then it's Republicans who are responsible for those groups' activities, said Jason Blazakis, former director of the Counterterrorism Finance and Designations Office at the U.S. State Department, who is now a professor at the Middlebury Institute in Monterey, California. "It's unfortunate, but I think in many ways this has resulted and served this reluctance in the Republican side to take as strong of action as they could." In interviews, veterans of the FBI, DHS, and other national security agencies recalled moments during the Obama administration when they realized the domestic terror threat was expanding unchecked. In January 2011, local police in Spokane, Washington, narrowly averted a tragedy when they redirected a Martin Luther King Day parade away from a roadside bomb planted on the route, loaded with shrapnel, coated with a substance meant to keep blood from clotting and wounds. At the time, it was one of the most sophisticated improvised explosive devices to appear in the U.S. 2 months later, the FBI arrested Kevin William Harpham, 36, a former U.S. Army member linked to the neo-Nazi National Alliance. "I remember being like, wow, we have a problem," recalls former FBI agent Clint Watts, a fellow at the former Foreign Policy Research Institute. "The belief was always that this would be Al-Qaeda, not a former soldier who was a white supremacist." In 2011, the Obama White House released a strategy to empower local partners to counter violent extremism. As part of that plan, DHS official George Selim was put in charge of leading these efforts as director of an interagency task force in 2016. Selim's Office of Community Partnerships, which had been set up a year earlier, grew to 16 full-time employees and 25 contractors, with a total budget of $21 million. As part of its work, it had $10 million in grants for local programs to counter propaganda, recognize the signs of radicalization in local communities, and intervene to stop attacks before they happen. But the Obama administration was wary of the political blowback, according to a senior government official familiar with the efforts of the FBI and DHS, and mindful of the government's lack of legal authority to monitor domestic hate speech, obtain search or surveillance warrants, or recruit sources. Meanwhile, the threat continued to grow, fueled in online forums. In June 2015, Dylan Roof, a 21-year-old who posted on the neo-Nazi site Stormfront under the screen name Lil Arian, opened fire in a black church in Charleston, South Carolina, killing 9 parishioners. Then Trump won the White House. In the new administration, efforts to confront domestic extremism came to a grinding halt, says Selim. The new administration redirected federal resources on Islamic terrorism. Barely a week into his presidency, Reuters reported that Trump had tried to change the name of the Countering Violent Extremism program to Countering Radical Islamic Extremism. The administration's reconstituted Office for Targeted Violence and Terrorism Prevention saw its mission expand while its staffing and budget were slashed to a fraction of what it had been, according to a former DHS official. The infrastructure we had labored over for years started to get torn down, says Selim, who also led counterterrorism efforts under George W. Bush. It has been decimated in the past 2 years under this administration. The Justice Department has also recently reorganized its domestic terrorism categories in a way that masks the scope of white supremacist violence, according to former FBI officials who say the change makes it harder to track or measure the scale of these attacks, which are often haphazardly classified as hate crimes or deferred to state and local authorities. The lack of clear data impacts the resources the FBI can devote to investigating them. A second senior government official granted anonymity to discuss the Trump administration's efforts says that while FBI analysts continued to issue warnings about the alarming patterns of white nationalist radicalization online, mid-level officials and political appointees quickly recognized that assessments that ran counter to what Trump was saying publicly would fall on deaf ears. That could cost you a seat at the table, the official says, although there have been fewer and fewer tables to sit at and discuss intelligence and policy. As President Trump has repeatedly downplayed the threat posed by white supremacists, he famously blamed both sides for violence at a white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, in 2017. Asked if he saw white nationalism as a rising threat in the wake of a March attack on 2 New Zealand mosques by an avowed racist who killed 51 people, he countered, "I don't really. It's a small group of people." In a nation where a mass shooting occurs on average about once a day, it is easy to be cynical about the prospect of change. But following the El Paso and Dayton attacks, there are glimmers of hope, however slight. The crowded field of Democratic presidential candidates has jumped on the issue, ensuring that the national spotlight of the 2020 campaign will keep the debate over guns and domestic terrorism from fading away. In Congress, Democrats have rallied behind legislation that would require DHS, the FBI, and the Justice Department to address white supremacism and right-wing extremism, including training and information sharing. Among law enforcement, there has been a new push for domestic terrorism to be codified as a federal crime. Acts of violence intended to intimidate civilian populations or to influence or affect government policy should be prosecuted as domestic terrorism, regardless of the ideology behind them, Brian O'Hare, president of the FBI Agents Association, wrote in a statement. Such a change would give prosecutors new tools to confront the threat of domestic radicalization. There has been a noticeable shift in how law enforcement and government officials talk about these attacks. FBI agents, politicians, and federal attorneys have become quicker to label extremist violence committed by Americans as terrorism. On August 6th, the FBI announced it was opening a domestic terrorism investigation into the suspect in Gilroy, noting that the gunman had a target list of religious institutions, political organizations, and federal buildings. The day after the El Paso attack, the top federal prosecutor in Western Texas declared that the incident would be treated as terrorism. "We're going to do what we do to terrorists in this country, which is deliver swift and certain justice," said U.S. Attorney John Bash. "This language matters," experts say. "If we cannot call an evil by its name, how can we hope to defeat it? You can't really deal with a problem unless you acknowledge it exists," says Mark Pitkovich, senior research fellow at the ADL's Center on Extremism, who has studied far-right extremism since the mid-1990s. We need a consensus that this is a problem, and we need to get together, irrespective of people's partisan beliefs or anything else, to confront this problem for the good of everybody. Reinstate the Assault Weapons Ban Now by Bill Clinton. In one weekend, 31 people were murdered and dozens more injured in two mass shootings just hours apart in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio. The death toll may still grow. The shooters killed the young and old, men and women. In El Paso, the white nationalist shooter's intent was to claim as many Latino lives as possible. In both cities, the victims had their tomorrows taken or their futures forever altered by domestic terrorists as they shopped or enjoyed an evening out. Everyday activities we all expect to pursue in safety. And in both cases, the gunmen used military-style assault weapons that were purchased legally. America is reacting as we have come to expect in the wake of mass shootings. Thoughts and prayers are offered as they should be. Communities come together as they should, and vigils to remember those lost and injured and to remind ourselves that we shouldn't keep letting this happen. Elected officials speak about the need for change, but the tragedies do keep happening. While the one thing that we know can reduce the number and death toll of mass shootings has not been done, reinstituting the ban on assault rifles and a limit on high-capacity magazines that was in effect from 1994 to 2004. Assault weapons are designed to inflict maximum harm in a short period of time. A 2015 study by Everytown for Gun Safety found that shootings where assault weapons were used resulted in 155% more people shot and 47% more people killed than gun incidents with other types of weapons. It should come as no surprise that when we see high death and injury totals from Sandy Hook to Las Vegas to Parkland to El Paso to Dayton, the killers have used these weapons. The Dayton killer shot 41 bullets in 30 seconds before the police got him. He killed 9 people and wounded 14 others, almost one victim per second. For too long, the gun lobby and the elected allies have stalled, deflected, and changed the conversation until the pressure abates and they can get back to business, heedless of killings inevitably yet to come. It pains me to see people in the culture I grew up in buy into the argument that banning weapons of war threatens the Second Amendment and their way of life. As the 1994 assault weapons ban shows, deaths from mass shootings fell while the number of hunting licenses actually increased. No one has to give up their culture to save the lives of innocent people, so many of them very young. The gun lobby often invokes the Democratic losses in the 1994 midterm elections after passing the assault weapons ban and the Brady background check bill to try to scare lawmakers of both parties into maintaining the status quo. Those who lost their seats in an election did cast brave votes to make our country safer and give our children the chance to grow up and live their dreams. The 2018 elections, thanks to the passionate activism of citizen groups across the country, prove that it's a different world now. Today, members of Congress will be supported if they reinstate the assault weapons and large ammunition magazine bans, and if the Senate passes the universal background check law already passed by the House of Representatives. Of course, no single action can completely end mass shootings and the wave of gun violence that plagues communities across America. We all have to stand against, not inflame, the racial, religious, and gender-based bigotries that often drive the delusions of mass killers. The red flag law is a good idea. Also, we can and should do more to prevent, treat, and manage mental illness. But the incidence of mental illness in America is similar to that of other wealthy nations, yet we have far more deadly mass shootings. What's different is the sheer number of guns per capita and the widespread accessibility of weapons of war. We know reinstating the assault weapons ban and the ammunition limit and making improved background checks universal will help. A 2018 RAND study found that policies that could bring about a drop in gun deaths as small as just 1% would mean 1,500 fewer deaths in a decade, and we can do better than that. We have talked, tweeted, and delayed long enough. This is about who we are as a country, what America will look like years from now, and whether our children and grandchildren will be safer and freer to grow up. I have always believed in the inherent goodness of people. I still do. I have spent my life trying to advance the idea that our common humanity matters more than our interesting differences in working for a world in which we are coming together, not being torn apart. We could take a big step toward that world by keeping assault weapons out of the hands of those who would wish to destroy it. The Power of a President's Words by John Meacham. It had been the grimmest of seasons. First, on September 15, 1963, Ku Klux Klansmen had bombed the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, killing four young girls. Then on November 22, John F. Kennedy was shot to death in Dallas. As Kennedy's body was lying in the Capitol Rotunda before the burial, the new president, Lyndon B. Johnson, received a piece of advice from Whitney Young of the National Urban League. I think you've got to point out with the death of President Kennedy that hate anywhere that goes unchecked doesn't stop just for the week. Young told Johnson, who was preparing to address Congress on November 27th, in the killing in Birmingham, the people feel that they can react with violence when they dissent. Johnson agreed and said he had included the point in his draft remarks to Congress. I dictated a whole page on hate. Hate international, hate domestically, and just say that this hate produces inequality, this hate that produces poverty, the hate that produces injustice. That's why we've got to have a civil rights bill, he told Young. It's a cancer that just eats our national existence. In the House chamber, speaking as president, Johnson told the country, "Let us turn away from the fanatics of the far left and the far right, from the apostles of bitterness and bigotry, from those defiant of law, and those who pour venom into our nation's bloodstream." The Johnson example came to mind in the wake of the white nationalist terrorist attack in El Paso. Our greatest leaders have pointed toward the future, not at a particular group or sect. Donald Trump, however, has risen to the pinnacle and governs while there with divisive and incendiary rhetoric on race, ethnicity, and immigration. Trump has spoken of the influx of rapists from Mexico and of an invasion of the southern border, a word that also appears in the El Paso attackers' online screed against Hispanics. The incumbent president has suggested that four female legislators of color go back to their family's country of origin. Three of the women were born in the U.S. and attacked U.S. Representative Elijah Cummings' Baltimore district as a rat and rodent-infested mess. A president sets a tone for the broader nation and by word and by deed helps tailor habits of heart and of mind. Presidential action and presidential grace are often crucial in ameliorating moments of violence. And the kind of presidential provocation we are now experiencing can help create and exacerbate just such hours. Trump's failure to do much more than tweet over the weekend of the attack, followed by his listless and unconvincing August 5th remarks about hate, stands in stark contrast to other presidents and other moments of crisis. From Bill Clinton after Oklahoma City to George W. Bush after 9/11 to Barack Obama after the church shooting, Trump's recent predecessors have met the moment in ways he seems unable to do. Well, it looks like I'm about out of time for this week. This has been Steve Ferrello reading Time Magazine for August 19th, 2019. Thanks so much for listening, and until next time, God bless.